is aborted, it has a human shape and movement, and they kill it. Whereas their, unless you just dispose of, whereas their whole training as nurses has been the service and the preservation of life, and they are now under orders to carry through its disposal. My question is how valid is the time point here, or is that just sophistry? That once you have a growing life in the womb of a woman, is there some point subsequent to that where that life becomes necessary to be preserved?
God has put each one of us as individuals, even while we're yet in the womb. I just read the verses just talking out to you. It says, for thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there were none of them. God knows us. He's our creator, and he knows us as individuals, even if he makes us in the universe. That's important to me from the same point. Where do we say life begins?
In the lower parts of the earth, there means the mother's womb, and that the shape of lump is known as God, is what the psalmist would say. And the question of when is a person, a human being, qualifying for his life to be respected and preserved, does enter, I suggest, into the discussion of euthanasia as well. Because there are hospitals which care for people who merely vegetate, who are just lumps of organic matter, from whom the person seems already to have departed. And the lawyers wrestle with the question of when is a person dead? And this has become particularly acute when the doctors are very anxious to get a fresh heart for a transplant. The sooner the better, and therefore the fear of their doing it a bit too swiftly. And the various ways there of when the brain waves have, there's no registration there, they're a person may be pronounced dead. We are equipped with more sophisticated medical technology nowadays to determine the end of life, than the old way of holding a mirror or a candle before somebody's mouth to see whether there was still breath coming from them.
I wonder if it might not be beneficial for us to take a look at what is actually said in the commandment. Does the commandment say thou shalt not kill? Or does it say thou shalt not do murder? Or you shall do no murder? It's very interesting, and I'm going to get back to the euthanasia abortion thing, because I've got some opinions that I'd like to at least share with the group. And then move on to the reverence for life after birth, which seems to me to be the one thing that we don't have, and the other may of necessity be a smokescreen for people who have no reverence for life after birth. The Old Testament, it seems to me, is replete with instances where people were killed. There are also instances where people were murdered. Now, it seems to me that the commandment speaks more to the doing of murder than killing. There are circumstances when killing or taking a life may be necessary, according to my own understanding of what the particular passage in the commandment say. Well, let's stop with that one first and see if there might not be some response to that, which then can get us on, I think, to the second part of our understanding what we are to be discussing here this evening, whether we are talking about killing or whether we are talking about murder.
Are you interpreting the word kill as murder? Is some early translation of the Bible or something saying murder rather than kill?
What I'm saying is that the commandment, thou shalt not kill, more accurately says thou shalt not do murder. You shall do no murder.
Can you kill someone without taking their life?
So the question is whether there it is right sometimes to kill a man.
Does it say in the covenant of Noah that if anyone sheds one man's blood, then his blood should also be shed? So in that way, then, when one man sheds another, then he should also be shed.
And that brings in the question of the sword that the government is entrusted with, and which he uses, which Caesar uses to take the lives of those who would be destructive of society, or those who would destroy our society.
Or even, I think philosophically we'd all agree that it would be wrong to kill, but then I think if we were honest, and some of us have killed during wars for our country, but all of us would probably kill an intruder who was about to kill a loved one of ours.
When is it our Christian duty to kill?
That's right. And I think philosophically we'd say no, never. But I think all of us would probably do this to protect someone.
And how far does it keep go on the death? The trigger cheek of the slap, all right, the trigger cheek of the bullet.
How do you interpret the difference of not doing the same thing as the law? I suppose the difference is you, instead of protecting, you protect someone else, not yourself.
Our Lord answered that one, I think. Peter tried to do that, and our Lord told him to put away his silly sword. That would do no good for Christ's kingdom.
Oh, but in your testament also, God was with the Israelites when they fought the Test War, and he wants them to do a certain thing, to get up and fight against certain tribes, to occupy a certain part of the country. And God was with them at that time. So was he really against all children?
I'd like to concur with that thought, too, that they were with them. Because the law was given on Sinai, and it was immediately after that, or 4 years after that, that he told them to go in. And so all the inhabitants of the land. So the differences are different between them.
Can I ask a question? Who has that kind of position with a political power that's going to make war, has that ear open to God, and it's God telling them? And it's also like me to see a modern nation really being able to, without any hypocrisy, say we're doing this because God wants us to do it, not because it's inconvenient for us. That's a mass movement, so not an individual position, say an abortion or a suppression. I think it's almost another area for me anyway, and interpreting. But I think it's really hard. I think we kill. If we kill, we have to be under forgiveness. That's not because it's our duty or that we're following God's will, but that it's killing herself. It's something related to what Bill was saying in how giving we receive. In the same sense, we're hurting more than the person killed by killing. I mean, if that does something to whoever does it, perhaps more destructive than what it does. Ending someone's life. I mean, you could take martyrs or saints or look at Pilate or, I mean, thinking that's what it's up to do.
The only thing I'd like to know is what is the difference between the two words murder and kill, besides maybe killing an infant because it's dying yet, because it's 5 years, an abortion and a living organ may not be a good life, but there's an argument.
Doesn't murder apply that you have hatred in your heart for somebody else, or malice in your heart for the person that you're intending to take their life? Isn't that the difference?
Is that the difference you would use when you do the distinction?
I suppose that I would well raise the example of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a Lutheran pastor, who involved himself with the underground and was one of the leaders in performing a specific chore, and it was that of killing Hitler. Now, I suppose it's been debated right and left to whether or not this is permissible on the part of a Christian man, let alone a Christian pastor. However, the rationale, at least as I read through some of the documents, is that the man was no longer a man. He had reduced himself to the biological animal that God had not intended him to be, and was endangering the lives of millions of people, had already been responsible for the murdering of 6 million, and consequently had to be removed. Now, I find it rather difficult to argue with that. Some of my Indian friends say that when Hitler reduced the Jewish population by 6 million, he deserved killing. They used this now to justify the Indian wars in this country by saying that the population of our people were reduced by 2/3 by the American settlers. Therefore, we had every right to kill them. Of course, those who killed the Indians, of course, interpreted this as a part of the manifest destiny of God.
And quoted the Old Testament Israel example.
Yes, yes. Go up and possess the land by every means necessary.
This has done no end of bedevilment. Israel is its own particular case.
That's right.
And they have their business to do and their orders, and we mightn't be very happy about the orders that they got, but that's one thing. But for a modern nation, to get itself into a position of holy war is utterly indefensible. And when the example of Israel was used for the extermination of the Indians, this was the most fearful abuse of Scripture.
That's right. Now, at what point now should the Indians have allowed themselves to be exterminated willingly because this was a part of the manifest destiny of the settlers, or should they have killed in order to protect themselves, their families, and their land?
I don't think that they should have attacked the settlers, because I don't think that the individual settlers did anything to them, but I think if they were attacked by an army or by a whole bunch of people, I think they certainly have the right to defend themselves and fight against these people.
Like Washington, the white people, the settlers, they'd like to hear how, you know, some people come in and say, I'm here, my place, get out.
Well,
and then you hit them, and then, you know,
didn't really
mean that
we were the settlers are going into the land property of the Indians. John, it was done much more subtly than that, though, in that the buffalo, for instance, in the plains area, it wasn't a slaughter of the Indians, but a slaughter of the buffalo, which produced starvation, which decimated the population. And the use of treaties and other methods to, you know, the legalistic approach to take away the land. It wasn't, you know, settlers barging in with guns. See, and this is perhaps how the whites in America have been able to justify it, that it was so subtle,
yeah,
in its approach.
And I think, Will, you have something about this murder by, we think of murder as anger.
What I'm trying to say is that we have to make ourselves credible to go to the second stage of the discussion, and that is the reverence for life after birth. Now, Norman mentioned earlier that, you know, the thing that comes to mind right away when we speak of killing today is the westward expansion of this nation all the way to Vietnam. That is, across the Philippines and all of the Pacific Islands in between to Vietnam. And there are some very, very interesting wrinkles to the cases which are presented now, you see. And it calls for at least some sober thinking. The trial of Lieutenant Callan, for example, who was charged with murder, I believe, of women and children at My Lai. His subsequent being found guilty and later on having the case against him dismissed by the president of the country. At what point do we authenticate a discussion of life and reverence for it, while we still remain silent, it seems to me, on some of the very, very, very shaky issues involved in war today. Almost completely as a result of receiving some theological information which best suits, it seems to me, the movement of people in this country. And here I must quote again both McIntyre, who claim, Norman, that the war that we fight now is a holy war. And God is on our side, and it is a part of our manifest destiny to give in order to protect the world from communism, I believe.
Well, we were probably as guilty as Bonhoeffer. He was probably right, but for the wrong reason. Now, wasn't Bonhoeffer making himself God when he was deciding that Hitler should go, whether his reasons were right or wrong? And perhaps this is our sin of judging, of feeling as though we are in a position of being able to judge who has the right to live and who is the right to die. This is probably the real sin.
I would hear the case for Bonhoeffer more strongly put in terms of his responsibility together with the men implicated in the July 20th plot as traditionally bearing responsibility if for the government in Germany. Men like von Stauffenberg and others, these were men whose families, by tradition, served the country and bore a responsibility for its welfare. And that the pressure of that responsibility was inherited from history, compelled them to do what they did. I think that is a stronger case than saying, here is a man who isn't a man anymore and can be gotten rid of, or by saying, I intend a good result by doing this, or I have love in my heart when I do it. Love, our hearts are pretty tricky and malleable to our purposes. But if one sees it in terms of responsibility for this nation, which those families traditionally bore, I think one can see a right for them to do this. The agony in which they found themselves was that they had given an oath, a personal oath of loyalty to Hitler. And so they were in the conflict of duty. And like all the decisions in the kingdom of the left hand, to put it sort of in Lutheran theoretical terms, the decisions in the kingdom of the left hand are always relative decisions. It is the choice of which is the less of two evils. These men did not eagerly take in hand to kill Hitler. They felt compelled to do it. They couldn't do anything else in that circumstance than get rid of this man because of the responsibility that they had for this nation in which their families had traditional and historic responsibilities.
One writer said, Norman, just to add to what you said, and I agree completely, was that should the plot have succeeded, then it is conceivable that Bonhoeffer and all of those associated with him would have been culprits of history. Should Bonhoeffer have decided to do it earlier than he did, then it is perhaps conceivable that the treatment of history of his involvement in this thing would have been radically different from what it is now. But they did agonize a long time and they, in the estimation of some historians, waited too long.
But they weren't all doing it for noble reasons either. As a matter of fact, the movement really gained momentum, I think, in about 1944, when it was obvious that their cause was lost. And also about that time, Hitler had taken over the duties of the chief of staff of the German army, and it was the officer of the corps who did not want to see their, in many cases now, many people were in for different reasons, but these were, some of the reasons were not so noble, of course, for the attempted assassination of Hitler.
I think we could never justify an action by saying, my heart was pure, because people seem to find an instant.
Bonhoeffer puzzled me too in many ways from what I've been able to read about him, and that of course he had escaped, he had left Germany and chose to go back, and I'd be interested in some comment on that. He seemed almost intent to be a martyr at this time.
I think he saw his responsibility to, with his people, and that he lives or dies with people for among whom he is born and of whom he is part and for whom and with whom he bears responsibility, no matter what the situation.
My thought was that men of his ilk were really going to be needed in post-Germany. And so this is my thought on that. I thought that perhaps he, there weren't enough of his type around, and the end was obvious. Time that he went to his death, and it seems to me as though he could have done more, but this, of course, is...
That's similar to that argument I remember when I was just talking
about how fabulous it is to be in Omaha.
And it sort of, to say that, it sounds crazy smart, but it completely goes against everything he lived for. And to say that he could continue and not take this risk and not go into the position because he would be needed later.
I think we can get off into discussions of whether other people did the right or the wrong thing. Each man has his own accountability and role to play, and nobody else was in Bonhoeffer's shoes but Bonhoeffer, in being placed as he was in history. But pick up the point of bearing responsibility for what happened in our nation. That was there in Bonhoeffer's family, for Stauffenberg and all the others. In the United States of America, who bears responsibility for what goes on? And could not a cogent case have been made for getting rid of Roosevelt?
The Georgia's case was made for getting rid of Lincoln, because all the plotters felt that they were acting out of their own moral judgment and that it was right to get rid of him to end this horrible war which killed off a third of the men in the country. And they thought this was reason enough to move Lincoln out. And they may have been crazy in their thinking and wrong, but they did it out with a certain amount of moral justification. Some extent of murder by inactivity or by accident. If all of the Western nations were to contribute half their income to the underprivileged countries of the world, which probably have a life expectancy of 20 years, we could, by giving them proper medical care and proper food, increase their life expectancy to, let's say, 60 years. Now, are we all guilty of their murder or of shortening their lives by 40 years by not taking this action? Or if you want to think in terms of accidents, we're killing 3 to 4 times as many people per year by car accidents, probably 2/3 of them needlessly by alcohol or by other drugs or by the fault of the driver as we are killing in Southeast Asia. And we have very strong moral principles about what we are doing in Southeast Asia, and probably rightly, but I don't think very many Americans are worried at all about the deaths that we cause pretty directly by our car driving habits.
But if you get in the car after four whiskeys, you're putting yourself in the position of a murderer.
Yeah, but by law, they consider it just one thing or another. Only if you run someone down purposely with a term that by law is murder, you know, which is unfortunate.
The point of a just war was raised, and that is generally used to justify taking arms in war. But to speak of a just war is immediately to imply that there are also unjust wars. And how does the Christian find his way to an answer there?
You're looking right at me. I didn't.
I think
so you want. I just
but I didn't quite see where that connection was, but
well, I think it relates to, like the Bonhoeffer for two. The point is, yes, Bonhoeffer knew he was doing wrong. He was, and yet he was willing to be, he was willing to sacrifice himself. And it seems to me that sometimes maybe we're called to do that too.
Well, I don't know if we're causing it. We might find ourselves in that situation, like this proverbial thing that the CEO, the draft board keeps saying, if somebody jumps through the window, it's going to rape your wife, what would you do? Well, I'd probably sin, boldly, hit him with a chair. But I would have to know that it was sin. I would have to know that. Because the minute I start saying, drawing, saying, well, now, let's see, the just killings, pretty soon, given, my mood, I can justify an awful lot, and I keep saying no, and thank you to God for forgiveness, and that maybe.
Many young black men who come back from Vietnam and can't find a job, and whom some of us have the responsibility of counseling with, since the San Francisco Bay Area is the favorite jumping off point for these men. In some dialogue, one young man says, well, what did the North Vietnamese people or the South Vietnamese people ever do to me? But George Wallace and Lester Maddox have done an awful lot. Consequently, it is perfectly justifiable then for us to pick up arms and defend ourselves and our mothers and fathers in Alabama and Arkansas and Mississippi and all of those places against the tyrannical rule of these men. Now, it is awfully difficult to offer arguments against that, given, 450 years of the history of the separation and almost total subjugation of the people. However, Judge, and this is why I agree, it is at that point that we must raise moral questions. And we must discourage that kind of activity. And we must speak about the reverence of life. It makes it difficult, however, when we are not supplied with overt acts and the required theological underpinning of the general and prevailing attitude of the nation that we are in. And I think that this is why it's so crucial, that Christian people address themselves to this, because I think that the question is a profound theological one, and it has to do with the peculiar posture of Christians in all of this. Now, there are some Christians who say that Jesus' admonition of Peter to put up his sword was not an ethical decision at all, but that it was a tactical one. He says, hey, Peter, we're outnumbered here. There are these soldiers with all of this armament and stuff like this, so we wouldn't dare go to war against these men because we're going to be wiped up. It was a tactical decision. However, those of us who understand as much as we can the mind of Christ know that not to be true. It was an ethical decision. It was one of the many exemplifications of the reverence for life on the part of our Lord. And so it seems to me that Christians then at this point are really at a crucial stage in the history of the development of this nation, and should be willing to enter into creative conflict, creative dialogue, to at least do some mind expanding on the question.
Is there a third possibility on that stadium? One tactical, one ethical, and certainly this sort of an observation, which maybe he was trying to pass on to us all the time, that if you people, or all people, continue to go this way, then obviously everyone's going to get killed. I have a Jewish barber who seems to understand our theology better than we do. And he doesn't get so complicated all the time. And if I see Jesus many times, it's just a simple, straightforward, fair thing. You take the strike, you're going to perish by it. Case closed. That applies to the blacks you're talking about, obviously. You take the strike, you're going to get killed. Not only if they take the strike, if we take it, we're going to get killed. We're fighting this in Vietnam. This is some people that are simplistic, you can't deal with Jesus that way. But again, I only refer to some people who seem to know something about the idiom. They say, why not consider it that way? Then we somehow or another, we seem to move away from mandate. We start seeing some things in a different way. Jesus, the savior of things, we might stop testing our spiritual pulse. Racking ourselves full of guilt. Say, this is the way the ball falls when we do that kind of thing. See, that's why you say it's a profound theological question. Then I would ask you the question, well, what does it mean by a theological question? But it's the third topic going. And I tend now, after many years in executing everything, more to go with Jesus along the way I thought. He was a great observer of human phenomena. And I don't know whether that's valid or not, but it does pose to the possibility for thinking about it.
Talking about eternal life. You know, life quotes on the other side of the grave. Well, that certainly does not match up.
No.
Huh?
No, Will.
Then let's not talk so much, Bill, about what he said, but what he did. Let's talk, for example, about his walking into the temple and picking up the book of the prophets in exile. And he talks about prisoners being liberated. He talks about blind people seeing, deaf people hearing. He talks about the poor having good news.
Good news for their bad condition, and that's part of it, you know, the alleviation of sin. It seems to me that I cannot really divide Jesus' spiritual life in the hereafter or in the now and life.
We can't hear over here, and I'd sure like to.
Question, would Christ raise somebody from the dead to a life that didn't have any particular value?
Why do you raise
somebody from the dead? Well, you better find out in your dream. I mean, you know, I don't. Wow. That really is really surprising. Question.
Well, we look in John's gospel, there's reference to the raising of Lazarus from the dead, and then the more example of what he was going to do to himself.
Okay.
And we've got two other reasons to the dead one. We've got the son of the widow, and we've got the Irish Jewish Lord. Thank you.
Maybe he was only asked those three times.
Well, what does Christ then mean by reverence that Christ didn't mean? I mean, I guess...
Well, he spoke of animals.
What he was talking was saying that ultimately, man's ethical responsibility is to have reverence for existence itself, that existence itself is sacred and holy. Consequently, man should not injure animals,
not waste, not malicious, not useless, or say, like, I cut down a tree in order to build a house. I revere that tree, I'm thankful for it, and in a sense, yeah, but what is that tree, you see, the whole connection, the reverence for life thing, the theme, the interconnections, the humans would die out as much as the insects if there wasn't kind of some kind of interrelationship between us. So it becomes irreverent when I cut down the forest just simply to get rid of the forest or to burn it.
Are you talking literally now or literally?
I think that's pretty literal.
Christ always said, Christ always knows the guys that were in charge of the jurors and athletes and standing before. They're against their shooting off certain numbers of animals, dogs, anything. The herd control for the welfare of the herd, but you're operating principle of the fitness of the majority.
Back to Jesus.
Well, I'd like to suggest that Indians are quite a classical example of carrying reverence for life, the ultimate, because there a lot of their population would be fed if so much was destroyed by the animals that they're preserving.
You mean the sacred cow?
not the sacred cow, the monkeys, the rats, the mice, the, I know when we were over there, they told us that the amount of people that could be fed that is destroyed by rats in this article. I don't recall it now, but it's a tremendous amount.
Of course, the sacred cow thing is a Western myth about India. They have no sacred cow. You see, the cow is a source of life for Indians, and so is the water buffalo. Pull their carts, pull their taxi, give milk for their children. They even use the cow's dung, you know, for fuel, for water, to cook their food. So you don't gore the ox, you know, that takes care of you. So it was laughable, you know, when we were in dialogue with them about this. They do kill rats. A lot of people
I don't think the fish kill animals. The fish, the sea, don't kill animals.
Well, the sea. Yeah, they are a real, real small minority.
Well, at least we were told by our Indian guide the amount of destruction there is from rats and all the animals.
Holy cow, and the Western. But you see, I think, Norman, that I am prepared to discuss, you know, slave death and that kind of life. However, again, I think that we don't negate, you know, our right to discuss that by not discussing the one thing that we're trying to get at initially, and that is human life. And I think that's where we are right now, with, you know, with the right of a human being to live, and the non-right of anyone to take that life for reasons which we've given already. Possession of the land, continuation of the expansion of an ideal, a culture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Of course, you know, what our enemies have in mind for us is not something that we've dreamt up. They have actually put this in writing. They have said what they are going to do. I'm talking about the communists. Yes. And there's no question about it that they're talking about the world revolution.
Do we strengthen ourselves, though, by saying just politically involving ourselves in something like the Vietnamese War? And even if you're going to say you take that position, but you still can't see that something like this war, or maybe any war now.
No, I said so we can't live in a vacuum. We just can't live in a vacuum
I mean without war?
No. I don't think that we are the only ones that have anything to say about this. This is the whole thing. I think it would be fine if we were all Christians and everybody felt the same and we all playing a game by the same rules. That's right.
But if we were to take the suggestion of the gentleman who was standing here, is he still here? The gentleman who was standing right here was talking about, ennobling life vis-a-vis aiding, you know, our brothers and sisters and other parts of the world who don't have enough. You know, he's saying reestablish our priorities. There are ways to win people besides going at them with nuclear warheads and fancy weapons of death.
That's right. There's so many ways of attacking the problem, though. And I think this is what we need. But we can't completely let our guard down while we're waiting for these things to happen. I think we have to stay ready. We have to protect our way of life.
Why are we
start working on the other one. Pardon?
Why are we waiting to attack?
Why are we waiting for them to have it? Because they told us that they're going to do this, you see.
Well, we don't write it down so loudly and go, you know, say what we're going to do. I don't think, I can't imagine that our leaders and businessmen are all, you know,
no,
real
not.
Good guys.
No,
you know,
that's
right.
A different word than you use way of life. Now, it's different from life. You're talking about taking the way of life. Are you still talking about the different life?
Yeah.
Somehow I've gotten to be the hawk here, and I don't want to be. But I think we'd be ostriches with our head in the sand if we don't recognize, though, that some people are devious, and some governments, some countries are devious. And they have said so. They have told us what they're going to do. And I'll get back to this now, and let's take it. This is an oversimplification, but if we are in a room protecting our children, and this man comes in and tells us that he is going to kill our children, now what should we do? How many would not protect his children?
Is Mike here? Mike Bolger.
Yeah.
He's called for the play.
Yeah,
thank you. But again, that is an oversimplification. But nevertheless, I'd like to know as individuals, you know, what you would do.
You said that we would be ostriches if we sat down and spread our hands and not realizing that some people are devious. Well, wouldn't we be the same ostriches if we didn't realize that we would be?
Oh, there's no question about that. Yes, we have to work, that's what I say, is we have to start working on our own, too.
And is it so much the killing of the children as that the children are going to be faced with another possibility? This life, way of life question might work into that. I mean, killing, if we're going to deal, I think you're dealing with something a little more subtle than just they're going to come and wipe us out. If that were the situation, well, praise be and hallelujah, we're all going to heaven, you know. You can always say that at the end. What's to kill our enemy for? You know, keep him alive then. That's the situation almost. But because we're not at, like you said, that is fairly simplistic.
What are our solutions then? What is the solution?
For what problem?
For the world, then, in order to, is it to just completely drop our defenses 100% and wait and see whether or not they are going to do what they said they were going to do?
Do we have a situation here of, when we say we, I'm really sorry, I really feel like I'm yelling because I'm, you know, I'm all down in the corner, nobody wants to see me, so I can keep talking, but, how can we just pass by our Christian responsibility that quite so easily is, it's not easy, but as you say, it's a practical world. This is the way the world is. And we can't live in it as Christians and act exactly as Jesus did, for instance, because this isn't the way the world is. And yet, where in the world is that excuse in the New Testament? There is no such excuse. I mean, that's another kind of sandwich.
Well, we all know what happened this time in 1948. And in 61, when I was in Hong Kong, I had an opportunity to meet with a Chinese pastor who was trained at Luther Seminary. He had gone out before the revolution and was unable to go back in after the revolution. At that time, he had been his wife for 13 years and his children. His wife tried to carry on Christian teachings in the home, and so consequently, one of their sons was sent on a chain gang to make the road in Tibet. He also told about a friend of his who came out at the same time he did. who his wife was writing a letter at midnight to him one night, and one of their children came down and said, "Mother, if I ever catch you writing to Father again, I'm going to report you to the police." So she wrote in her letter, "This is the last time I'll write to you. I hope I'll see you in heaven." He told us of another Christian who refused to make his pulpit into a communist propaganda platform. And so he was, of course, forbidden to preach anymore. He was forbidden any livelihood. He had to sit on the street and beg, and the people were told anyone who gave him any food would be given the same kind of treatment. And so he was in such bad condition the last time he heard his wife. He was just praying that the Lord would take him home. Well, in South Vietnam, you still can preach the gospel today. Now, whether this means anything to us or not, I don't know. But I feel that this is very, very important.
Then, ma'am, I would like to suggest in the United States we can't preach the gospel today. In Lutheran churches, we can't preach the gospel today.
Why?
Because a lot of our younger pastors who try to speak to issues as they are today lose the pocketbook and are refused calls and are shipped to Siberia by district presidents. I say what's happening at Concordia Seminary is no different than what happened in China. I know of pastors who are forbidden to preach. I've had them in my home looking at some of our publications which were investigated by Washington too, and saying, "I can't say no to war in my Christian congregation. I'm sorry, but I must eat." Now, that, I propose, is no different than the other situation.
He can at least get a job in America.
Well, just a moment. I'm saying that he can't preach the gospel, and that was the issue that you brought up. See, I'm only pointing to the issue now. I'm not saying what he can do. I'm saying in Lutheran churches in the United States today, in many Lutheran congregations, it is forbidden to preach the gospel, and we have ample evidence of this. Now, I'm just saying, so it depends on where you're standing and looking. Another thing, too, if you look at Chiang Kai-shek and talk about the flying gold over the hump to he and his robber barons and to the bankers, and where the money never got where it was meant to go, Chiang Kai-shek probably is one of the greatest larcenists the world has ever seen. And so we can't say, well, that he was a great Christian. I had, incidentally, a martini with Walter Judd shortly before I think the man is desperately ill at the moment. But now I voted for Walter Judd. I'm sincere about this. The last time I saw Walter Judd was in Madison, Wisconsin one night at a motel. And by this time now, he is talking almost psychotically about what's coming out from under the woodwork.
Yeah, you heard him in channel.
Did you hear him too? And it's frightened me because I understand that this mindset is possible for any one of us in this room. For me, I know what this is like. I don't know how many of you have those same sensations.
Yeah.
We can let this myth, all these myths grow. We can say, less than so. But you see, two nights ago, I had the most interesting conversation from a man from the Department of Defense, a civilian. He's been in Vietnam for 34 months. He says this is the most ridiculous thing he's ever seen. He talked about Westmoreland, he talked about Pew, he talked about all the generals. He says, "Do you know what's the problem over there?" I said, "I think that we don't know what those people think." He says, "Precisely."
We have no idea about the mindset. We have no idea about the mindset in China. Not even the pastors are not. And another thing, you see, the reason we know this for sure is because those of us who are pastors here in the United States in our own congregation didn't even know the mindset of the people that we're talking to in the pew. I thought I knew it when I was preaching to the people in the pew until I left the congregation, got on the outside and found out I didn't even know who these people were. So it's a very precarious thing to deal hypothetically with what brings certain things about. We're dealing with the mind of man, and which is past finding out. And so I don't know what all this means, but I think what Jesus is talking about, in answer to your question, he said a very simple thing. We can take it or leave it. When your enemy says, carry my armor one hand, you say, I'll carry it two. Now, if he said that and meant that, that's kind of an interesting statement. I don't know what I want to do it, but I do know that he said that. And whether he meant for us to keep out of trouble that way, or whether he meant us to conquer the enemy that way, whatever he meant by it, I do know he said it. And I think these are the problems we have to deal with. What did he mean? The thing that bothers me most of all about us in the church is we're illiterate about Jesus. We just absolutely don't know who the person is, what he did, what he said. We have no way of saying, what does our leader want of us? Where do we talk about this? I've never gotten to seminary. I asked a professor from Luther Seminary a couple months ago, are you going to teach about Jesus next year? And he said, I don't think so. No, we're going to do the synoptic gospels again, or something.
Now, I remember saying once, I'm not a capitalist. And right away, the reaction was, Then you gotta quick say, I'm not a communist either. I'm a Christian, and that makes me a strange breed of cat. Because Christians pay obeisance to no system, especially if that system has built into it those elements which tend to oppress and suppress people. One of Jesus' followers said, perfect love casts out fear. One of the few passages which means just the opposite when it's turned around. Perfect fear casts out love. Consequently, I go through an awful lot of exorcism in order to prevent myself from hating Russians, or red Chinese, or being fearful of the fact that they are either going to attack me or beat me at ping pong. And I think that United Airlines, since it's now bickering for exclusive rights to fly into China now, the president at least would probably agree. And it's an economical reason. It has nothing to do at all with the polarization of ideology, you see. I think that one of the things that we're grappling with, in addition to some of the other things, is fear. And the fear has names and faces and complexion. And I don't know if we can, quote, defeat communism by fear. If we want to defeat it. Or if our mission, rather, you know, according again to the revealing of Christ in this world, is a different mission than that of responding in kind to some of the idiotic and asinine antics of God's creatures.
Cool.
a permissive and affluent society, that we might be right under the judgment of God's dictatorship. Now, I don't advocate this. I'm just saying that, this might happen because of what we've been doing or not doing to freedom.
Does the Christ so say somewhere in the Bible that nothing, no government has been put on the earth that hasn't been approved by God?
Let every soul be subject unto the higher power, so they are ordained of God and only spread the kingdom. But it doesn't advocate a system of government.
Wouldn't that mean he approved
nothing?
The
communism? Pardon?
Wouldn't that mean he approved the communism? Or does he say...
No, I'm not saying that. I don't think that at all. I don't think he approves of any government that would suppress the people. But in the Old Testament, when Israel was disobedient to God's covenant, God permitted the enemies to suppress her and come upon her. And she was a holy nation ordained of God. And the Christian people within America are that holy nation ordained of God.
But you see, we're looking at this all through Western life. This is where I think we get screwed up. We interpret the Bible the way our Western mind is to interpret it. Now, the Jews, and I talk to my brother about this too. He says, if you want a good reason to do something, call it God. Why should you say that Moses sent us out to kill all the Midianites? You need a better authority. And so when they threw the coin at Jesus, he could have said, well, I know what you're trying to do to me. You want to catch me. Obviously. If Caesar's head is on that coin, I think it must belong to Caesar. Give it to him. You see, it could have even been a Jewish joke. Mm-hmm. It could have even been a piece of Jewish humor. And the point is, and I think it's about, we've got to start seeing the Old and the New Testament as humor. Basic. Now, if we take this mindset, it starts to get very redundant. And it starts to free us up. But if we return to the literal Western interpretation of what the Greek, here's the Greek, and here's the idiom, and here's the Aramaic, and then there's that, and that, and that, and finally there's the mind of some guy who said something, and we don't know what he said, but we think we do. So when I came to the seminar and I want to write on my thesis, what do they want me to write about? Tiffany. I don't even say, what is that, by the way? This was supposed to be my thesis. It's a Greek word, I'm sure. And so I asked the guy who told me I should write on Tiffany, how many of those do you have in the archives of word groups? Well, he thought maybe 72. Well, I said, don't you understand what it is yet? Tiffany. Now, the point is that nobody can write about Tiffany. I don't suppose, because at least nobody I know. Jesus walking about, did he form a government? He didn't have time. He had something else to do, something that was very important. It would be like saying, did you ever form a government? No, you didn't, because forming governments is not your business. Like you said, you're no politician. I don't form governments either. But to take Jesus as the master plan, then he should be forming government. But that wasn't what he came to do, to form or to deform government. I think the thing was right over here. He said, I'll give you abundant life. Now, you're probably going to get killed. You know, as a matter of fact, I'll put us right on the line. You're going to get killed. They're going to throw you out of the synagogues, right? They're going to drive you out of the city. They're going to call you radical, communist. Going to come out with a gun, they're going to do all that to you, but that's abundant life. And then I'm going to show you how much it costs. I watched from Jericho all the way to Jerusalem, huh? They try to talk them out of it, didn't they? It shall never happen to you, he says. Get thee behind me, Satan. I'm going to show you what it means to live. And that's where the cross came out. Now that's what we're stuck with.
But what was their propaganda that his followers were proclaiming?
What, his followers?
Their shtiz, their deal, their propaganda. It was one thing, the resurrection.
Yeah.
And that got them into trouble. Not who to vote for. not who received. Oh, no, no, the gospel of the resurrection.
Oh, no. I disagree. I don't think that. No, I don't think that's what got them into trouble at all. Anymore, I don't think that got them into trouble. If they'd stuck with that, that wouldn't have been so bad.
What they did because of it.
Huh? I'm not sure about that, but I'm just saying.
What I was getting at, back to this government idea, is that no matter what, how rotten the government might be, he needs some sort of law and order, because he's by nature a child of wrath. That is his sinful nature. It's just like a church without a shepherd, no matter how poor the shepherd is. You still need some leadership, some dedication, and something there. I'm not, there are better and greater and lesser forms of government. But I just feel we need this, because without it, life is chaos.
Well, we seem to keep picking blind leaders, right?
We seem to be slipping more into what is there we usually put under the fourth commandment rather than under the fifth, and the whole matter of life and its uses and disposal. And the distinction perhaps that was implicit here was that it wasn't the work of Jesus to put governments or be the police that put people in prison for destroying society, for some other reason. And he said that his undertaking was not helped along with a sword. He won his victory holding to his purpose with a love that went all the way. And that's the only kind of victory that are his kind of victories. And his people live the way it's described in the Sermon on the Mount. That's the way things go among Christ's disciples. Christ disciples are there for him, for one another, for their neighbor, for people. There's more to the world than the family, that the people of Christ. And the Sermon on the Mount does not give instruction how to run a government. It describes how Christ's disciples live. There's the world around the church, all the non-Christ or against Christ set of the world, and how do we live out there? There we have a different task, but the same motivation, as is described in the Sermon on the Mount. We are there for others. We are at the disposal of people. When it comes to running a government, that is a particular kind of job, and we put ourselves to that. But that's a different game than the church. And there, the sword and justice are the operative principles. And in these, and in this area, there is only a relative right. And the choice between which is the less of two evils, and the discernment of which is the less, is something that we have to work out with our noddles, and that we don't get the answers for from reading the Bible. And we cannot arrive at the point of, since we do not have the direct statement, we are not given specific directions
scripture, this man you should kill, this man's life you should serve and foster, the decision when to do what is something that we have to agonize with in the particular situation in which we find ourselves. Whatever we do, we will not be able to say that was not sin. Whatever we do will need to be forgiven. Every decision, every action is something that we do so that we may not hold outside the need of the forgiveness of Christ. When it comes to the classic case is we revert to the point where all killing is sin. The case of the ship's officer who finds himself in the lifeboat that is built for 20 people and he finds 30 in it. His task is to throw 10 overboard so that 20 may survive. When he says his prayers, he will ask God to have that decision and that action within his forgiveness. But at that point, this is the unavoidable decision that he has to make in the line of his responsibility for the people in that lifeboat. So we have to be careful against generalization, nor nation of a thing that this is now a sinless action.